Today on the Inside Flap.
I got an elk last year, and now though the biggest impetus for hunting is I've got three daughters who are real foodies. They're real into locally sourced food and that kind of thing. So they put pressure on me to go get an elk. I was invited to the White House to meet Dick Cheney's vice president, who is from Wyoming, and his wife is a big fan.
Oh,
and
nice.
We spent a half an hour and found out talking to each other, not about politics, but the fact that we'd both been arrested by the same game at one time in Wyoming.
Now I'm standing there in my stocking cap. Sylvie's there in her stocking cap. And we look over and I look at the probably 500 to 600 people. And I start counting how many people are not wearing helmets. There are probably about 10 people who are not wearing helmets. And Sylvie and I are two of them.
The Inside Flap is available on demand every week on iTunes, Stitcher, the Google Play Store, and around the world on theinsideflap.com.
Podcasting live from Littleton, Colorado, this is the Inside Flap Podcast. Thank you guys so much for joining us. My name is Dave Medicus. Welcome to the show. Seated across the table to my right is Andrew Dowd.
Excelsior.
And to my left is Laura Medicus.
Howdy.
Howdy. We thank you guys so much for joining us. We appreciate you listening. We have a book recommendation podcast for you today. That's this show. That's called The Inside Flap, and we welcome you to it. Thanks again for joining us. So we have a new sponsor for the show. Our show brought to you today by Books A Million. Books A Million, also known as BAM. They are the second largest bookstore chain in the United States. And if you go over to our website, theinsideflap.com, you'll find some great deals there. Just use our link to hop on over to the Books A Million site. And we thank them for having us aboard. We got a big show for you today coming up. CJ Box joining us. Really excited to welcome him aboard. The number one New York Times bestselling author of 27 novels, including the Joe Pickett series. His latest is number 20 in the series. It is called Long Range, and man, it's a good one. Laura and I just read it. We'll talk about that book in just a little bit, and we'll talk to him. We had a great conversation with him. We've got three new book recommendations coming up for you, plus an audiobook of the week, YA shout-out. Big show for you, jam-packed, but I want to get you... Want to get you guys started with a little story. I took Sylvia skiing last week. Now, Andrew, you go out skiing a little bit, don't you? I know you've been hurt recently, but before then, you like to go skiing, yeah?
Absolutely. I mean, Colorado's a great place to go skiing. Lots of choices here.
That's right. So, took...
Good year for it.
Yes, it is. Yeah, a lot of snow. Took Sylvia up to Copper Mountain. Now, listen... It'd been a little while since I've been skiing, and apparently there's been some changes afoot.
Some advances.
Changes a ski, if you will, on the slopes up there. We went up there on a Saturday morning, so we fought a little traffic for an hour or so getting up there.
Nessa, hang on here. Most of the people that I know that leave to go skiing Saturday morning, they leave around 5:30, 6 a.m., Well, so where do you fit in that spectrum?
I know two people who are not going to be getting up that early, and one of them is named... So, we rolled out of here around 9 o'clock. No, maybe 9:15. You know, no hurry to get up there. It's not like we're going to be on there on the slopes all day long. Both of us, kind of beginners, especially Sylvia. But she wanted to get out there, and she wanted to give it a shot. So... We followed the traffic, parked in the satellite lot, hopped in the shuttle bus to go over to the slopes, get in another line to get our rentals. Now, the first thing that I noticed was different about the rental area, and this was great. When you go to get your boots, everything is streamlined now. So to get the boots, you walk up these wooden steps, and then you get on like this elevated platform, and the people... putting the boots on you are down below, so they're standing up, so they don't have to kneel down anymore to put your boots, and they do it all for you. So they're like down there, you look down, it's like you're standing on the cliff's edge looking down there, size 10. They go and scurry over, grab the size 10 boots, come over, You lift your foot up, you kind of pop it in the boot, and they strap you on and set you on your way, and you're good to go. Then we go over there, get our skis, get our poles. Sylvia opted not to get any poles, which turned out to be a poor decision on her part, as you'll see in a second. Then we get outside. Now, before we go out there, after we got our poles, and they said, do you want a helmet? Now I look at the guy like he was crazy. We're going on the easy slopes. We don't need... I'm like, no, we don't need any helmet at all. We'll be just fine. So we go out there, and I said, no, I don't want any helmet. So we go out, and as soon as we get out the door, the lift is right there, and there are hundreds of people right lined up for the lift. Now I'm standing there in my stocking cap. Sylvia's there in her stocking cap, and we look over, and I look at the probably 500 to 600 people, and I start counting how many people are not wearing helmets. Mm. There are probably about 10 people who are not wearing helmets, and Sylvia and I are two of them. Yeah. So quickly, I turned us around. We went back inside and grabbed some helmets.
Yeah, helmets are pretty much mandatory now. And the thing is, even if you used to not wear a helmet, the fact that everybody else is...
Mm-hmm. Should tell you something.
Well, exactly.
Well, yeah. Not that, but if you have a collision with them...
Oh, good point.
Right?
Good point.
Their helmet's going to smack in your head.
Good, yeah. That's an excellent point.
Well, I had no idea. It's just been a couple of years since I'd been out there, and I did not remember the great proliferation of helmets on everybody. But anyway, we got the helmets. Then we get up to the ski lift. So we wade our way through this big Disneyland-esque line as lines are merging together. And you get on the lift, and there's four people to get you on the seat. And we're shuffling along. Now, when you get right up to the front of the ski lift, you got to hustle because these chairs, they don't wait for anybody. They come whipping around. And you got to be lined up on that little blue line on the ground. And as the chair catches you and whisks you up the mountain.
So time in chair lifts waits for no man.
Those are the two things, yes. And the group ahead of us, the chair came around, swooped around, they plopped down, the chair went off, and then it was our turn to scoot forward. Well, myself and the two other people, we stick our poles in the ground and slide right forward. Then I look back, and Sylvia's still standing back there trying to shuffle her skis together to catch up. Meanwhile, here comes the chair. Well, the guy starts screaming at her, and he just takes her by the arm and pulls her, half pulling, half pushing, to get up to the line, to get up to us. And she was horribly embarrassed.
What happened again?
So what happens is the chairlifts are moving pretty fast.
Uh-huh.
And there's the point in time where you are on the line, where you're the next people to get on the chair.
Okay. And you really have to hustle.
You have to get up to that line. So you got to get past the point where the chair swoops around. These chairs are going in a big loop.
And
you have to get up to it before the chair gets there.
Huh. Now
that sounds like a nightmare for someone like me. I would get panicked.
So not having a pole is not the issue. But typically, for kids, they recommend the kids don't have poles. Oh. But typically, the parents will give one of their poles to their kids.
Oh, I see.
Well, that's interesting.
Interesting,
Andrew. I know one guy who did not know that. So she was kind of left behind, and the guy had to drag her up there. Because what you don't want to do is you don't want to have them hit the red panic button to shut down the whole ski lift. And then, that would be mortifying for anybody.
Oh, that'd be so embarrassing.
To Dave's defense, I mean, you're more of a cross-country skier.
Yeah, exactly.
Downhill is just a whole...
It's a whole other ballgame that I was finding out.
Now, thinking about this, I mean, one of the problems with skiing is, let's count the lines you had to wait in. You had to wait in a line to get up in traffic up the mountains.
Yeah.
Yep.
You have to wait in a line to get on the bus.
Yeah.
Well, yes.
You have to wait in a line to buy lift tickets.
Yes.
You have to wait in a line.
Well, we actually bought tickets online, but that had to wait in line to pick up the tickets that we bought online.
Yeah, so that does a lot of good.
Yeah.
Then you had to wait in line to get your ski equipment.
Yes.
And then you've got to wait in line.
Yes. It was lunchtime before we'd even gotten up on the slopes.
Yeah.
I'm like, man, I'm starving. We still haven't even hit our first run. But we got up there. Now the ski lift turns... Well, first it turns into a selfie paradise. Sylvia's getting selfie after selfie. We're taking pictures of herself.
Mm-hmm.
But then we get up to about halfway up the mountain, and then it turns into, Daddy, how do I get off this thing? I'm like, the panic. Yeah, this is going to be, you got to be ready. Okay, you're going to want to have your skis kind of slightly tilted up so they don't grab you on the ground and drag you down. You want to have them angled up, and you got to be ready to hop off the chair. You got to hop off the chair so the chair doesn't swing around and leave you on it as it goes back down the mountain. So you got to be ready. Oh, okay. All right. How do I do it again? Where my skis are pointed down? No, skis up. Why are my skis up? No, so you don't hit, so they hit the ground. But what if I can't get off the chair? No, you get off the chair. You just hop off. How do I jump? Oh man.
She hasn't been skiing in a while. No. I guess she just doesn't remember.
Right. And you don't. And you started having worst case scenarios start flying through your head left and right. And there are two other people adding to the pressure that are sitting there with us. Neither one of them speak English, so they don't know the consternation and fear that we're going through. Oh. So they can't help us, out of our stress.
What language were they speaking? Out of curiosity,
they were whispering to each other in another foreign tongue. I don't know. They're speaking softly to each other. I don't know. Hmm. We got helmets on. You can't. It's kind of they're. I had my bared ear to them. I just know they weren't engaging us in conversation. Maybe I assumed they were speaking another language. I don't know. It didn't sound English to me. Anyway, so we got up to the top, and I helped Sylvia up. She was able to hop off, no problem. We got out there. We spent about 15 minutes studying the sign to figure out the easiest possible way down the mountain. We had a nice, gentle run down. Only problem... We did fall down once. Now, the interesting thing is that we actually weren't moving when we had our collision. I said, let's stop off here, take a little rest. And then the first thing we do, I take out my phone and we spend about 15 minutes trying to get the right background. You want to have a good picture, So there's trees in the back, but we want to get a nice vista. So we line up the shot. And then as soon as I go to take the picture, she slips and starts sliding backwards down the mountain because we're pointing up. So I reach around to grab her. And then as I do that, the phone tumbles into the snow. Aww. Then I go to reach down for the snow. I've still got a hold of her. One ski starts going down the mountain. The other ski starts going up the mountain. And I start heading into my first ever split, which was very painful. And I just kind of slowly, softly did a shoulder roll into the snow, grabbing Sylvia down with me. We ended up with our skis and our legs tangled up in this pretzel shape. And it took us a good 15 minutes to get ourselves back up
Did you have any witnesses?
I'm sure there were, but my head was angled in such a way and my neck was contorted in such a way that I couldn't see people near me. We were off to the side. But I go to move one leg, and the ski would go one way, my boot would go another, and I see now why we were wearing helmets, because our skis are whipping around each other as we try to lift ourselves up just to get out of there.
That's funny.
But we finally got up and got back down. Had a good couple runs. Then Sylvia said, "Why don't you take a run by yourself?" So I did, and I found out what the spooky hour is. Andrew, have you ever heard of the spooky hour?
I have not.
The spooky hour. Yeah, well, apparently, the spooky hour. I was going up, when I went up by myself, I got up on the ski lift, and there were these three young kids, and I was sharing the lift, and they were talking about shredding and hitting up the other side of the mountain and taking another up on the other side of the bowl and doing some more black double diamonds and this and that. And this one kid said, "I want to do one more run on the other side of the mountain." Because if, you take one ski lift, then you take another ski lift to get up to the top, and then you can ride down the other side into the big bowl there. But he says, "No, look at the time. It's almost spooky hour." And I was like, what the hell is spooky hour? But I didn't want to say anything. I didn't want to play. I was trying to play it off cool. They weren't even looking at me. I was just sitting there.
They don't care.
They don't care.
You're just an old dad.
Yeah, exactly. And I thought, what the hell is spooky hour? Well, then what I can figure out is the time between 3 and 4 in the afternoon when, I guess, the snow would start icing over. Because the sun has, by this point, dropped behind the mountain. And they finally talked the one kid out of it because the other two were afraid of hitting the slopes at spooky hour.
Well, and that's the problem is it's faster, but the problem is you can't control or stop as easily.
Right, exactly.
Right, so
yeah.
There's... But now, growing up on the East Coast and skiing, it's pretty much spooky hour all the time.
That's true, yeah. Not out here with the nice powder that you get. Yeah, but It was a good time as we got closer up to the top, so that we had the wind had picked up a little bit too, so they'd pulled down this big shield, it was like a big blue shield, a bubble that kind of ensconced us in this.
Really?
I'd never seen that
under
before.
The dome, Stephen King style.
It was real nice, and we were very excited to pull this thing down, and there was a sign there that said the shield will automatically raise as you get up close to
to where you're going to jump off.
And these kids, they couldn't. Do you think it'll automatically? I don't know. Just raise. We need to raise it. Guys, we need to raise it.
Sylvia would have been doing the same thing.
The other guy's like, no. The sign says it'll automatically raise. But the other two outweighed this kid. So they pulled it up. And as we got up to the top, he finally engaged me after a 10-minute ski lift ride. The one kid finally engaged me in conversation. He turns to me. He's like, do you think it would have raised up? I said, yeah, I think it would have raised up. And he turned to his friends. This guy says it would have raised up. That's all we got out of them. But it was a good day on the slopes. I forgot one last thing. So at the very end of the day, we sit down and we're going there to shed off our ski rentals. And I sit there, pop off the skis. You know, we walk over there, walk downstairs to take off my boots. And I look down. Now, I thought that my boots were a little loose all day long, but I figured, I guess that's the way they do it. And yes, the guy had strapped two straps in, but when I looked down, they were the bottom two straps. He had not wrapped the straps around my ankles.
That's funny.
And I'd been skiing all day with loosened ski boots.
They're not going to do everything for you.
Just thinking that the guy
they did everything for me.
Did it all for me. No,
that's funny.
Not so. But perhaps we'll get out there again sometime this winter. Laura, how was your week?
My week has been filled with low-level anxiety.
So we had some high-level anxiety on the high ski lift. What was your anxiety about?
It started when I, I go to a tile place an awful lot. I'm there an awful lot. If you look at Google Earth, my car is sitting in front of this tile place. It's no joke.
At all times.
No joke.
And is it really?
Yeah, it really is.
That's funny.
And there's a sales rep that I know very well. I've worked with her for probably at least 5 years.
Yes.
And she says, Laura, last night I went to the grocery store with my sister. We filled up two shopping carts. And we prepped.
Oh, yes. The coronavirus.
And I perked up like you would have thought she was telling me about a new, beautiful new tile that she had just got into the showroom.
Yes.
Yeah. And so I said, sit down. Tell me.
Tell me more. Let me pull up a chair.
Tell me more.
Please.
Yeah. So she prepared for the coronavirus. And in her defense, she has a young child who has illness. So he's allergic to a lot of things. He's always in the hospital. Mm. So he's, one of those probably at risk.
Right.
And she was afraid. But I don't have, thank goodness, anyone in our household that is at risk.
Right.
But I still was filled with anxiety. And I also immediately turned on like the news when I got in the car to listen.
There's your first mistake, right?
Much attention. And Dave, this is what my brain sounded like. Panic, panic, hoard food, panic, panic, looting, fires, panic, hoard food, board up windows, panic.
Board up windows?
Yeah.
Man.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
Oh, no.
Oh, no.
Really?
Mm-hmm. Oh. And so I have been slowly doing the accumulating food. And like Tylenol and Gatorade and stuff like that accumulation.
The powdered Gatorade.
Now, the powdered.
Yes, we don't have room to put all
those
bottles.
Don't have room for that. And I don't want to do all the plastic also.
Right, yeah, good point.
Mm-hmm. I'm not a monster, Dave.
No. Get any sardines? Now, you were telling me
like
that one of the tips you'd heard is to only prepare food you'd want to eat. So hoping there weren't some sardines.
My sales rep was saying that she got a bunch of like soup and stuff like that, like canned soup and stuff.
Uh-huh.
I don't really like canned soup. I actually don't know that she likes canned soup either. So my strategy is buying duplicates of things that I know we eat anyway. So we've just got them there.
Right.
We'll eat through them. I'll buy another one, you know,
Makes
and I'll
sense.
Just always have like the double up of the item.
Twice as much stuff. Yeah.
Twice as much rice. Mm-hmm. Twice as much goldfish. Crackers, not goldfish. Stuff like that. Just oatmeal, things like that. And anyway, I've been trying to resist my inner hoarder, my inner prepper.
Well, I know how hard that is for you.
Because I want to be a rational person. But then I'm also still getting emails from like lighting reps like, oh, we only have 10 of this light fixture in the country. We don't know when we're going to get any more from China. It might not be until July.
Wow.
Just all kinds of manufacturing issues because of the virus.
You've been going around listening to this all day?
All day long. All day long in my car. White knuckling it.
That and this.
Andrew. Yes, panic, panic. Board up windows.
Panic, board up.
Hoard
panic,
food.
Watch
hoard
out.
Food, hoard medication.
Get food, get food, get medicine.
Looting and fires. So, panic.
You know, so I get it. And I thought about this week. I was thinking about, man, you know, should we do some preparation?
They say 2 weeks. You need to have 2 weeks of food.
And I was thinking, you know, let's just buy a 50 or 100 pound bag of rice, you know, and everything else
just gonna eat rice.
We'll sort itself.
We'll just eat rice.
It's like Survivor.
You know, a lot of soy sauce and, and rice. So I asked Katie, I'm like, Katie, should we, you know, you think we should prep anything? She just looked at me and scoffed. And that was the end.
Wow. Shut you down.
Over here at the Medicus compound, we will share. I am not that type of prepper.
Now, if you can make your way over,
if you can make your way over, we're going to have rice, beans, goldfish crackers, popcorn, lots of stuff like that. Gatorade.
Plenty of books on hand. I don't know how much science fiction we have, but...
if you bring the plywood, we can board up the windows together.
Well, just about the time our pets start looking appetizing, we'll come over.
Yeah, we don't want to turn this into an omakase Donner Party situation.
No. I'm definitely the type of sharing prepper because I feel like we need to... I like the idea of like pooling our resources is appealing.
The forced community, the band of misfits who have to gather together
and candlelight
and fight the end of the world. So, a lot of candles,
candlelight,
a lot of candles. Make sure we have plenty of matches and lighters on hand.
Is this the beginning of like that? The Stephen King. What's a Stephen King?
The Stand. Yeah, The Stand.
Oh, here's something funny.
Laura made a great reference. Oh. Yes.
If anyone out there hasn't read Chuck Wendig's The Wanderers. It is so good. You need to get your hands on this book. It's an 800-pound novel. It is so...
800 pounds.
800-pound. 800-page novel.
That's a lot of words.
Thank you, Paul Wilson. Yeah. And in this novel, this virus starts with bats. Where did the coronavirus start? Bats.
How did he know?
I don't...
What?
No.
Are you serious?
Yes. Bats.
Man.
Yeah.
Chuck Wendig.
Mm-hmm. It is an excellent book. Also, heavily
prescient
into Colorado and Uray, Colorado.
I don't know if it's a good time for someone to write a book like that or a bad time.
I think it's always a good time.
Do people want to read that when it's actually going on in real life?
I don't know if you want to read it when it's going on.
No, but maybe after this passes, then
maybe
he'll look like a freaking genius.
Yeah, that's true.
Wow.
That's true.
Chuck. Chuck Wendig. Hashtag Chuck.
I thought, Andrew, you might have been prepping.
And like I said, I thought about it, but Katie scoffed at me, and that was the end of that.
Shut you down. Tisked.
But are you ready? Did you get an email? We've gotten emails from the schools saying that they will shut down and follow procedure.
Absolutely.
I've not read any of those emails. And I've gotten emails from our private physicians.
Uh-huh.
I've gotten emails from work.
Yeah, we have too.
Now, I got an email from work that basically said, if you go
hoard food.
If you visit China or any of these places, you need to quarantine yourself for 14 days. So the place I work.
Do they go to China? You guys work in China?
Oh, not really. Oh. But it doesn't matter if you go there on vacation or whatever. But they want the
employees. No one's going to China on vacation right now.
to do a self-imposed quarantine.
But you know, one other thing too that's interesting is men in China got the virus a lot faster than women did in China. And it's because the men don't wash their hands as much as women do.
What?
So putting this out there for the male listeners, wash your hands.
I'm staring at
wash
my hands
them more
right now.
More than you think you need to.
I hardly ever wash my hands. I need to need to be better. Look at those nails.
Yeah, because they were like, why are men getting affected more by this virus?
And they don't wash their hands.
No, it's funny because one of my favorite places for lunch is this Vietnamese restaurant. Mm-hmm. You know, where I get a nice bowl of soup and everything.
Yeah.
And so I went there on Thursday. I had this first day. I had a break to go. and it was like a ghost town in there. And, you know, and I'm sitting there wondering, is this because of the coronavirus that that people are like staying away from Asian restaurants?
It's a bit of a conspiracy to, to leap to that conclusion.
This place
else could explain it?
This place is typically packed. But, you know, the Vietnamese place, there was
I actually wouldn't be surprised if they experienced a decline.
Yeah, there was me and one other person. One other person in there.
Were they wearing a mask?
Interesting.
Well, you know, and you do see people walking around with masks and stuff, but, but you know,
but you know, if they have, if someone has a flu or something like that, you know, you're told to wear a mask.
Well, and
if you have to go out,
as Katie's research on a news source, she's told me for weeks, the masks just don't do anything.
Masks don't help with this particular virus. Yeah. But that's interesting.
It, you know, and hopefully it fades away, right? I mean, hopefully it doesn't like spread and it fades away.
Oh, I think it's going to spread. I think it, I think it's coming.
Yeah.
I don't think it'll hopefully be as awful as we're preparing for, but you know, I like to feel prepared, and by doing it also makes me like scratch that itch of like, oh, I've got lots of food here.
The show has reached a new low.
I've got the plywood to board up the windows. Yeah. I'm ready.
Yep. Always, always.
Don't have
ready.
The water, though. I haven't hoarded water, so. I
fill up that bathtub. Start drinking out of the turtle tank. I'm looking at that turtle tank over there.
How's your week, Andrew? I know it's been really busy for you.
You know, it's been a busy week. So, you know, same job, but I'm doing a new task. And basically, I've got 7 o'clock meetings, right? And so to get out of the house and get to work and be sitting there at my desk, you know, ready for meetings that I have to lead, right? I mean, you know, so I'm getting up at 6 o'clock and 5:30, you know, and the days are still long, right?
Mm-hmm.
But it's, you know, so it's been fine. So we're actually recording on Saturday morning because then I had a software deployment Thursday night.
Yeah, when you told me, you called because you couldn't get a hold of Dave. And I was like, oh boy, Andrew Dowd's calling me. What's going on?
Something
and then he
wrong.
Says software deployment. In those words,
I picture
military. Yeah, I pictured military. He's leaving in the dead of night.
We've
Katie's
got a
crying.
PC, crisis.
He's got
in Kuwait.
His fatigues on. What is a software deployment?
My bifocals and my combat boots.
So you think about it. You know, so I develop software that can, you know, services software that will be in front of millions of people.
Okay.
And so you know, the impact of anything you deploy. You have to carefully deploy it because basically, I mean, it could
some bugs.
It could
and
either
stuff.
It could be good or it could be very bad.
Yeah.
And so the deployment is you have a team of dozens of people, all basically sitting around watching one guy push a button.
Really?
That's pretty much what it is.
Whoa.
Right. And so you got
and
one
waiting for problems
for
to happen.
Bad
one
happen.
One click of a mouse that basically will deploy the software, right? And then everybody's. Then,
do you do like a countdown from 10 or anything like that?
Well, you do. A person's like, okay, I'm getting the code ready. the code is deployed. Code is deployed. And then,
people, we're live. We're live, people. We're live.
Yeah. And then everybody's checking. Everybody's checking things, right?
Yeah.
Okay. Yes, service A is looking green. Service B is looking orange. Oh, no. Wait a minute. That's just bad lighting.
We got something on the branch. No! Shut it down! Shut it down!
Yeah, because then you have to get ready to roll it back if things...
Roll it back.
If things don't look the
like
way...
Like Walmart.
Yeah, if things don't look the way
so what,
it's supposed
what
to.
Could possibly... What could... So if this goes awry, what would the ultimate outcome be? Someone can't watch NBC? What are we talking about?
Well, this time of year, especially with the tax season, so I work for a financial institution where people have trillions of dollars invested. And so, you know...
Trillions.
Literally.
Trillions.
Trillions of dollars.
Wow.
And so, basically, if things go wrong, people can't access their money. And especially in tax season, especially when there's financial turmoil.
Yeah.
You know, somebody goes to log into their account and can't.
Oh, I can't even imagine.
You know, I mean, and then they'll start picking up the phones and the call center calls will start go off the
boy.
You know. So that's that. But
so you guys didn't cause that big drop in the stocks on Friday, did you?
No, are we sure that was not the...
They deployed it. Andrew deployed new software, and the stocks take a tumble.
We're
seeing a spike in Littleton in the call center.
I have a question, Andrew.
Yes.
The other night, I heard you on the phone with Dave, and you were looking for rats, I think, in the dark.
Oh, yeah.
What was going on.
So... the chickens are no more.
Right.
They're basically at a another family.
Bid them a fond adieu.
Down to the farm.
And so now we are still dealing with the aftermath, which is we have a professional
Kentucky Fried
pest control. And so we've got bait boxes and stuff out there for the rats. And so, you know, so the rats, basically, if they die from poison, you need to make sure you get rid of them.
Yeah. And so you don't want an animal eating them.
Yeah. And we don't want our dogs to eat them. Yeah. And so basically I have to go out there on rat patrol looking for dead rats. And every couple of days I find a nice big juicy rat that died in the yard.
Oh man.
Wow.
He's the reverse Pied Piper.
Yeah.
Wow.
So, you know, it's, you know, I think we're seeing less activity, but the Terminator comes out and basically
says, has there been a lot of rats that you found dead in the yard?
Probably half a dozen or so.
That's a lot. Oh, yeah, man. That's a lot.
More than one is
that's
a lot.
That's a lot.
Yeah.
Yeah. Well, I mean, when we knew the rats were moving a pile of dirt every night, about a foot and a half high. So how many rats do you think it takes to move
half ton of dirt?
You know, a lot.
And we're, and we're not
the math.
And we're not talking about Ben here either.
No, we're not, are we?
And the mighty rat.
Yeah, the mighty rat. So, you know, it is what it is. And the last thing we want is, you know, rats in and around the house. And we live on a canal, so I mean, unfortunately, it's conducive, right? And it's a great thing about where we live. I mean, we've got, like this morning, red tail hawk, ducks in the canal with the red tail hawk looking for a victim.
Mm-hmm.
We've got like some sort of like seagulls or something that fly around. I mean, so the wildlife is great.
Yeah,
coyotes, bobcats, all that stuff. But unfortunately, you know, if you see the wildlife you'd like, there's also going to be the wildlife you don't like.
And yeah, the moral of the story is don't have chickens near your home.
That's the moral of the story.
And
yeah.
I wouldn't want to live next to someone with chickens anymore after learning about this.
And you think about it, it's, you know, it's like that famous song says, you take the good, you take the bad.
We'll be hearing from that song in just a little bit. Well, speaking of wildlife, it's time for our conversation now with CJ Box. His latest book is called Long Range and is number 20 in the Joe Pickett series, a series, by the way, that just keeps getting better and better as it goes along.
Yeah.
This is another entry, Long Range, in the Joe Pickett series. In this one, Joe and his wife are empty nesters, and Joe is just a little bit lonely. But conversely, Nate, who's Joe's, speaking of birds, Nate is a falconer. Joe's longtime right-hand man with a shady past who's always done his own thing and lived by his own set of rules, legal or not. Well, now Nate finds himself with a baby in the house. It's great to see these characters, you know, grow and just adapt over the course of these novels. That's really what stands out in this one for me.
I had someone also say to me, oh, CJ Box, he writes for men, but I've been liking CJ Box books for a long time.
Yeah. I know my mom's a big CJ Box fan,
and I don't find mine is too. And I don't find myself like a particular, like I'm not like seeking out Ernest Hemingway style books all the time.
Right.
Yeah, I really appreciate him. I think his main character, Joe Pickett, is he's the kind of guy that I like to read about, actually.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
He's a family man, game warden. You know, it's great to read about.
I like
Wyoming,
his attitude towards life, towards he doesn't see the world in black and white. He's an interesting character.
He really is. The storyline in Long Range concerns a sniper who's in town. He's taking shots at people, beginning with a local judge's wife, a bullet that seemingly was meant for the judge. And now Joe and the local cops have to figure out who exactly had it in for the judge. Adding in the mix is that there's a new sheriff in town. No one can stand this sheriff, particularly the cops who have to work for him, and also Joe. There's particularly interesting is some carryover from the previous. And this is one thing I like about these novels is you see how they not only evolve, but you get carryover from the books before. In the last book, Wolfpack, there were some dealings with a shady Mexican gang. Well, now they're back. There's a vigilante who's out for justice, who's hell-bent on killing Nate. This is all very, very exciting stuff. These are characters we've grown to love. There's the trademark humor. The mystery is outstanding. The thriller aspect is tense. Mm-hmm. And there's also some gory bits about a grizzly bear.
Oh, yeah.
And who doesn't love that?
Frightening.
Laura and I both enjoyed this book immensely, and we both really enjoyed chatting with CJ Box about it. The Nuggets, the Denver Nuggets. Turns out he's a big Nuggets fan. Mm-hmm. That was fun to talk to him about that. Living in Wyoming and a lot more. So here's our conversation with CJ Box.
Yeah, I'm gonna take my horse to the old town road. I'm gonna ride till I can't no more. I'm gonna take my horse through the old town road. I'm gonna ride till I can't no more. I
got the horse. You know, we're big, we're calling you from Denver. We're big Denver Nugget. We're actually season ticket holders. Went to an event last night. We got to meet the Nuggets. So really, really pumped up about them this year.
Oh, very cool. Oh, me too. I've been a long time Nuggets fan. I watched them when they won 10 games one year.
Oh, wow.
No, they're so exciting. We just love them. And we can't make as many games as you do, but we try to go as much as we can.
Yeah.
Wow, that's awesome.
They're so exciting to watch and to see Jokic and Murray run the two-man game. And then now we met Bol Bol last night. Now, that guy is tall, man. That was pretty neat to see him. Because I grew up watching his father play in D.C., Manute Bol. So it was neat to meet his son last night.
What I can't believe is that he's a three-point shooter.
I know.
I want to see him unleashed.
I know. I've seen the highlights, and I just watch him over, and I'm like, look at this guy shoot. How is it possible for a guy that big to have that touch? Hopefully next year. It doesn't look like this year, but it's nice to see Michael Porter Jr. get out there. We met him last night, too. Our daughter was beyond excited to meet him.
I would be, too, because I have such... I mean, there's been such glimpses of what he could do. I mean, he could be, I'm preaching to the choir here, but I mean, he could literally be the superstar on the team if he pans out the way he could.
Yeah, agreed.
Yeah, we hope so. We'll see. Anyway, it's been a great ride so far, and we're just gonna play it out and see how it goes. Anyway, listen, I've been a huge fan of your books for a long time now, and your latest one, Long Range, does not disappoint, as I knew it would not. This tale of a judge's wife shot from a seemingly invisible foe, a cold-blooded avenging vigilante on the prowl, and a baby for Nate. CJ Box, what inspired you to write this book, Long
That's
Range?
Right.
Yes. Gave him a baby. Nate, come
well,
on.
You know, like... like with all of the book, you know, all the books in the series, they're told in real time.
Yes,
and
love
so this
that.
Is the 20th one, and things have really changed. I mean, Joe Pickett, when the series began, had two little girls at home, and then a third, and we've watched them grow up, and now they're all in college or getting jobs, and now Nate, the outlaw falconer who's got his own sense of justice and done all sorts of things, yes. is now at home with his wife and baby and trying to figure out what kind of Pampers he's supposed to buy.
I know.
So really I like funny. The way that's developed. You know, things have really changed over the years, but Nate is still Nate, and Joe's, learning what it's like to be an empty nester. And it's fun to write. It's fun to kind of change up the books and keep them fresh that way.
It really does help to keep things fresh and yet still have that familiarity that readers have come to expect and just love about these characters. And just to see them grow, it's just so much fun for a reader. Now, listen, I love the opening chapter in this book. We, as readers, are witness to a single bullet flying across the landscape past unsuspecting wildlife as it ruthlessly and relentlessly travels on its deadly mission over the course of just a couple of seconds. Now, I got to ask you... Now, it's a great scene, just a great way to start off the book. I really loved it. But did you get a chance to shoot a rifle like this? Yeah, you're welcome. Did you get a chance to shoot a rifle like this? In the name of research, of course.
I try to, track the trends. And I know I've got a lot of friends in Wyoming who have become long-range shooters. And some participate in contests. And, there's a couple of places where you can shoot. Thousands of yards around here. And I just became fascinated at the fact that this technology existed now. I knew, military snipers have been doing this for years, but anybody with the money can now buy a rifle and an optics system and be able to hit things thousands of yards away. And I went up to research this, went up to the Gunworks manufacturer in Cody, Wyoming, who makes a lot of these guns, and their claim to fame is they match the optics with the rifle and pre-sight it in, and you buy it as a package.
Hmm.
And their claim to fame is, you can hit something at 1,000 yards straight out of the box. And
wow.
You can,
wow.
In fact. I went up there. They showed me the technology. I was hitting steel targets at 1,200 yards that I couldn't see with the naked eye.
Oh, man.
I was amazed by that.
Does that make you want to close your blinds just a little bit tighter at night? I mean, that's got to be a little scary. Well,
it is a little bit scary. You know, there are hunters. There are hunters who use this for elk hunting and other kind of things. But it changes the dynamics of ethical hunting to some degree.
Absolutely. Yeah.
Although, when I asked them about that specifically, they said, you know what, a lot of these guns are backup guns. That when a hunting guide has a client who might take a bad shot and wound something that starts to get away, the guide can finish it off and not make the animal suffer. And I thought, I'd never thought of it that way. But it is fascinating that this technology exists.
Yeah.
Yeah, it really is. And speaking of hunting guides, there's an incredible grizzly attack also at the front of this book. And I personally have always felt nervous hiking up in your neck of the woods in Wyoming near the Yellowstone area. And I wondered what inspired this human grizzly attack, which is frightening for hikers and campers everywhere.
Well, what inspired it was an actual event in the Teton Wilderness area. A local Jackson hunting guide and his client from Florida were hunting elk. They were archery hunting. Hmm. And two grizzly bears came just thundering out of the mountain unprovoked, man, and attacked these guys.
Wow.
Killed the guide, him and mauled him. The client got away and contacted, you know, local law enforcement. And the weird thing about this attack was that, you know, usually when people are attacked, it's because they happen to walk between a sow grizzly and her cubs or something like that.
Yeah.
In this case, they didn't do any of that. They were just walking around and were attacked. Wow. And the grizzly bears that killed them hung around for 2 days.
Oh, man.
And, wow.
They didn't feed on the hunter and they didn't feed on the elk. They just hung around. So they were almost like homicidal grizzly bears.
that's a frightening thought right there.
Yeah. Do you carry bear spray, or what do you do to protect yourself against a grizzly? Do you talk while you're walking out there?
I definitely carry bear spray. I've talked to guides and game wardens who, although they're heavily armed, most of them who are experienced will say they would go to the bear spray first,
okay,
before they'd actually pull a gun. Because it's not only the bear, it's not only the pepper spray that will repel the bear. When you shoot bear spray, it comes out in a huge red ball.
Wow.
And that sight sometimes will stop a grizzly bear.
Oh, okay.
Sometimes,
yes.
Yeah.
And the dead guide that they found that I was telling you about, when the investigators found him and rolled him over, his bear spray was underneath him.
Oh, wow.
Didn't have time, maybe.
He'd used it on the bears, but it didn't stop them.
That's the absolute. I took one of those training courses too, and that's what's so frightening is they said you got to get it just right, wait for the bear to start charging you, wait until it's like 3 feet away from you, and then unleash it. I'm like, there's no way I'm going to be crapping in my pants and running the other way. I'm not going to be able to make that kind of astute judgment that quickly.
They found the bears, they killed them, and they autopsied the bears and brought them in, and one of the bears was still had so much bear spray in its coat that they had to open all the windows in the room.
Wow.
So, yeah, that's a creepy one.
Man, wow. That really is.
Not making me want to camp up there anytime soon.
No. Well, listen,
yes. Wyoming is filled with Colorado campers.
It is. That's true. I bet you hate them too.
That's true. You see that Colorado license plate. You're like,
Now, speaking of injuries, there's a character in your book that gets tased. Now, I don't want to spoil it and say who, but there's a massive tasing that goes on. Now, you mentioned you go out and shoot guns for research. Did you get tased as part of your research, or do you only do the fun stuff, like flying drones and stuff like that?
I only do the fun stuff.
Okay, all right.
There are a lot of videos that exist of law enforcement training where people are tased.
Yes.
So I look at those and, you know, to see their reaction, see how it works, and then try to describe it accurately. But no, that's one thing I'm not going to volunteer to do.
Yeah. I'm guessing you're not sitting down with a nice hot meal either and pulling that up on the TV, kicking your feet up and watching some tasing videos. That's awesome. How much of that can you...
No, not at all.
We talked about this a little bit, or you did, but I love that Joe Pickett ages with his readers. And do you enjoy writing for the older Pickett? It's just, it's a pleasure as a reader. I've read him for such a long time now, just to have him kind of grow older with me. And it's just kind of cool.
Well, good. Well, thank you. Yeah, I do enjoy it. And I think you probably noticed over the last few books and probably in the future, sometimes, he climbs off the horse and just his knees hurt really bad.
Yes.
And he's not exactly beating people up and jumping around, but aging, I think, naturally.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Now, I also like, it seems to have, and even one of the characters makes a reference to the names you give in some of the characters here. Orlando Panfile, we get Becky Barber's son. Becky Barber's son is awesome. Love that. How do you come up with the names?
I come up with names from two sources, really. One is the Professional Rodeo Cowboys Media Handbook. Rodeo cowboys have such great names.
So yeah.
I usually choose one first name and one last name that aren't the same person, and put them in. And I've done that for years. But the other thing is that I give away, I donate a lot of your name in a CJ Box book of items to fundraisers around the state, around the region, around the country. So people, in effect, buy their way in. And they have to sign a release that says they have no editorial control of how that character is used, how that name is used, I should say. So about half the names are from people who want their own name in a book or want a family member or a friend. And I don't ever match the name up with the act with the character. It's just a name.
Right. Okay.
But there's a whole lot of those.
Well, you got to be careful. I'm assuming some people might submit their enemies' names in the hopes that you might kill them off. So maybe that's just something I would do. I don't know.
I think that has happened. And I probably killed them off.
That's funny.
Some sweet, sweet vengeance there. I like that. Now, listen, you talk about in this book how money and class really doesn't impress or mean anything to these Wyoming folk. Now, you live in Wyoming. Is it true? Do you find that's true from your perspective? Now, you're a big-time writer living up there amidst the locals. How do they treat you up there?
We've lived here a long time. What I find, honestly, is that people seem to be kind of proud of me.
That's awesome. The best.
And they're pretty protective in their way. There have been people who've come to this area wanting to figure out where we live, and nobody will tell them, which I appreciate.
Ah, that's great.
And I think you can look at Kanye West up in Cody now, where people are likely to see him in the hardware store, but nobody makes a big deal out of it. They figure if he likes to live here, we'll just accept him, and if he doesn't try to Bigfoot us, we're fine.
Now, do you raise cattle at all?
We don't raise cattle, but we have a little ranch, and we lease
the
meadows to a local rancher who runs cattle on it. And then he pays us for it in beef, which is great.
Oh, that's nice.
That's fantastic.
That's a good situation. Yeah.
The freshest cut. So you're eating pretty well up there, huh?
Yeah, we've got lots of meat.
No vegetarians in the house then, I'm guessing.
That's right.
Yeah. Do you hunt? Do you hunt at all? Do you do any hunting?
Yes, I do. I'm not as passionate a hunter as I was when I was young. But I got an elk last year. And now, though, the biggest impetus for hunting is I've got three daughters who are they're real foodies. They're real into locally sourced food and that kind of thing. So they put pressure on me to go get an elk.
That's great.
So now, just like CJ Pickett, you've got the three girls. I love that.
Yep, that's true.
I love that.
You've never gotten any trouble with a game warden, have you? That would be ironic.
Oh, you know what? Yes, I have.
Oh, really? That's when you whip out one of your books and say, look at this. I've done more for Wyoming game wards than you've done in your entire career. How did that work out for you?
I would do that now, but at the time, it was back in high school and college, I encountered a few game wardens while out in the field doing the wrong thing.
Mm.
But I came to respect them, you know, they handled things. And a few years ago, and it was very interesting, I was invited to the White House to meet Dick Cheney, the vice president, who is from Wyoming, and mm-hmm. his wife is a big fan.
Oh,
and
nice.
We spent a half an hour and found out talking to each other, not about politics, but the fact that we'd both been arrested by the same game at one time in Wyoming.
That's so right. Yeah, I forgot Cheney did have plenty of hunting stuff going on. Did your run-ins with the game wardens in any way help inform the character?
Yes. The fact is, yes.
Okay.
You know, the way that I was on site and saw them handle certain situations and actually provide some discretion when they didn't have to do it, and some consideration of what the hunters in the field were doing. So it kind of, you know, there are a few really hardcore types, law enforcement types, but generally because they live in the community and they know people and they know maybe this guy stepped over the area he was supposed to hunt in, but he's also feeding his family, they might just kind of look the other way. I like that kind of approach.
Yeah, yeah. That makes a lot of sense.
And I see you have a new TV series coming out called Big Sky, brought to you by a very big name, David E. Kelly. I was wondering, first of all, congratulations.
Wow,
I was wondering
really if you're excited.
And
thank you.
Yeah. Have you been involved at all? Are you hands off? How does that work?
Well, I'm an executive producer, which my name will be in the credits.
Yeah.
But they're going to film it. It's going to be actually this fall on ABC. It's happening very fast.
Oh,
they're
nice. Hiring
actors.
Awesome.
Every day I'm seeing announcements of new actors being hired. But David Kelly, he's been really great to work with because he really does appreciate novels and novelists. And the things that he's adapted have all been very, very good. And I read the pilot script that he wrote a couple of years ago for this series, and it was fantastic. And so I will not, I don't want to be involved in anything day to day, but, you know, if they ask, I'm happy to consult. And he's taken some suggestions that I've made about the characters in the area.
Awesome.
Very seriously and incorporated. So I'm excited about it. It's a whole different deal. And there's also a Joe Pickett series in the works with Paramount Television and Charter Spectrum. Ooh. And that's probably, it's a much longer away, probably a year or so away, but they're developing the first 10 season or 10 episode season. And then once they get that all in the books, then they'll start, you know, location and act.
Oh, man, that
so
is
on.
Great. That is good news. That's exciting.
Yeah.
That's awesome. You know, that's really exciting stuff. Maybe we can see I got to ask you this, though, but so now that Joe Pickett's getting his own TV series, you got your Joe Pickett, of course, and you got your Walt Longmire. Let's say you got a mystery to be solved. Who would be the best man for the job? It's got to be Joe Pickett, right?
Well, I would think so. He's based in Saddle String, but different books have taken place all over the state. So I think unless it was highly localized, I think, you know, Joe has more range.
There you go.
Yeah.
Yes.
Yeah.
Yes. More, like he's got a long range, if we can say that.
Right, that's right.
But look, I love the Joe Pickett books; absolutely love them. But one of your favorite books one of my favorite books that you wrote was Blue Heaven, the story of a couple of kids on the run and a rancher who covers for them amidst a small town with secrets in Idaho and some really bad men. You won the Edgar for this book. Congratulations on that! But where did the impetus for that book come from? I just love that one so much. I read it and then I went back and listened to it again. I really love that book. Where did that one come? How did that one come about?
You know, I can tell you exactly where it came from. I was on a book tour for one of the early Joe Pickett books, and one of the bookstores in LA was frequented by a lot of local cops. They really liked the owner because he was ex-law enforcement himself. And one time we were having a book signing there, and one of the cops who was kind of helping move people along said, "Oh yeah, I've got a bunch of friends of mine who've retired and moved out to Wyoming.
Ah.
And, you know, bought big houses, and you know, I'm looking forward to doing that myself." And I know Wyoming well enough to know there's not a lot of ex-LA cops in it. So I figured out it was Idaho and panhandle of Idaho. And that's I went up there. And at that time, that's where Mark Furman moved from LA.
You know? Wow. Yeah. Yes.
At the time I wrote that book, there were over 1,000 ex-LAPD in that panhandle.
Wow.
And so the book just kind of came from that.
Yeah. What a great idea for a book, and just so well executed. Really, really love that one.
Thank you very much. I'm really proud of that one.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Yeah, absolutely. What books, so when you were growing up, what kind of books did you read? Did you read a lot of Westerns growing up?
You know, I didn't read a lot of traditional Westerns. You know, like Louis L'Amour kind of books. I didn't read a lot of those. My favorite authors are Tom McGuane and Joseph Heller. Catch 22 is my favorite book of all time.
Yeah.
So, you know, I just kind of read widely and always kind of felt like so many of the writers who were writing about Wyoming and the region were kind of doing it from the outside in rather than the inside out.
Yes.
And wanted to try to rectify that.
Hmm. Did you always want to be a writer when you were growing up?
I did. Yeah. I didn't know what I'd write. I you know, I remember being, you know, going to the Natrona County Library in Casper as a young boy and try to figure out, you know, walking down the, you know, to find the bees and figure out where my book would be someday.
Oh.
But, you know, I never really thought about a series or, I didn't, even with the first book, Open Season, never really thought of it as a mystery. I thought it was just kind of a contemporary Western novel.
Yeah, that's interesting. I can see that.
You know, I was a newspaper reporter, and I think it came from there.
Oh, gotcha. Wow. Yeah. I think that a lot of writers kind of start with the journalism and turn into that. Not a lot, but it seems like people we talk to tend to do that.
That's true.
And I find as a reader, most of the series that I really enjoy the most, once I dig into it, there's a former journalist. I mean, like Michael Connelly and others have that background.
Uh-huh.
It's interesting, isn't it? It's a truth-finding, questioning personality, perhaps.
I think so. And then, you know, being able to write on deadline and fact-based and straightforward.
That's true.
It's true.
And not, you know, I think people who have creative writing backgrounds have a different approach.
Yeah,
that's an interesting point. Yeah,
it seems to be. Well, listen, we'll let you go. We really, really loved your new book, Long Range. Loved all the Joe Pickett books. You know, you do a great job about writing. You know, we came from the East Coast, and I always just love reading your books, throughout the years here. And it's one of the things that brought us out to the West for sure. So we really appreciate with all your books and your time for dropping by. Appreciate it.
Well, it's my pleasure. It's been fun. Thank you very much.
Yeah, and go Nuggets. Let's go. NBA Finals this year.
Okay,
we just got to get past the Lakers.
It is. The team that scares me is Houston, though. They don't match up well.
No, they don't.
Well, you know, now they got Capella out of there. I feel like Jokic could have a field day with them. You know, they're playing small ball now. The Rockets have had their number for the past couple years, but since they've switched it up, we haven't played them yet. So I'll be curious to see how it goes.
Yeah, me too.
Yeah. All right, man. Well, take it easy.
Right, thank you.
I appreciate it.
Thank you.
Bye-bye.
Bye.
The Inside Flap.
Oh, great guy. Sad to see the Nuggets got killed last night in their game against the Clippers, but I'll be back to fight another day. I don't know if he was watching or not. All right, well, let's open it up. Yes, it is.
Book reviews.
Let's start with
Laura Medicus.
Laura, what book do you have for us this week?
I have Thunder Bay by Douglas Skelton.
Thunder Bay.
Mm-hmm, this is a Dave Medicus kind of book.
Oh, really?
Yeah.
Really?
Dave Medicus.
Oh, tell me more.
It's dark crime fiction. It's set almost entirely on a small island, on a small island off the coast of Scotland called Storm Island.
Did you grab a book from my stack?
It's possible I did. I'm not sure. Yeah. So when I first read about this island, you take a ferry to get there, I was thinking, I'd love to visit this place.
Yes.
When the book starts off, the island seems lovely. It's sunny. There's seals. There's picturesque coves, harbors. It's a small, quaint little town. But then, as the story gets darker and darker, the island does too. Stormy, windy, incredibly cold. Not a place at all that sounded touristy to me at the end of the story.
Not a place to go.
No, okay. No. So this book is about a young reporter named Rebecca who travels to the island from the mainland to cover the return of a man named Roddy. Roddy was accused but never convicted of brutally murdering his girlfriend 15 years ago. Roddy's mother has died, and he comes back to the island for her funeral. It's the first time he's been back since he was acquitted of the crime. Everyone thinks that he did beat his girlfriend to death 15 years earlier, and there's a lot of bad blood toward him. Rebecca, this young reporter, she knows is around, talking to people, and it all starts to get really messy in a hurry. And then one thing I was thinking about because of the way this reporter, I mean, she's interviewing people who've had family members die and tough things that I wouldn't want to do. But when I was in middle school, I remember saying to, I think I was thinking this and saying this, I'd like to be a reporter. I want to be a journalist. And then I found out what they have to do to get a story. I think I had a teacher tell me. Yeah. And I thought, well, there's no way I could ever do this job. A
lot of phone calls.
They talk to people who don't want to be talked to. Right. They talk to parents of murdered people, children, the children of murdered parents. They don't engage in easy chats. And I am someone who likes an easy chat.
Yeah.
Like, I like having an easy chat.
They're not out there making small talk.
They're making hard phone calls. They're knocking on doors. They're not taking no for an answer.
Persistence. Mm-hmm. Yeah.
I don't have that.
No.
No.
You're not caught from that Edward G. Murrow.
No.
Or that Edward G. Robinson.
Murrow.
Edward R. Murrow.
Edward R. Murrow. Yeah. So I enjoyed reading about the journalistic. I liked living vicariously through her uncovering stuff. So this book has a mystery at its center. Did Roddy murder his girlfriend, Mary? And on the way to figure this out, there's a lot of deep, dark, and I mean dark, secrets that are uncovered. Dave Medica-style dark secrets that I will not give away. Almost everyone on this island is hiding something terrible.
Huh.
So this island is murderous and claustrophobic. It's the type of crime fiction that Scottish and Irish writers do particularly well.
Yeah.
And this is called Thunder Bay by Douglas Skelton.
So does this... is there any like supernatural elements to this?
No supernatural. Okay. Unfortunately, it's human. Human caused tragedy. Yeah.
It's, all right.
Yeah. I don't know why Scottish and Irish writers are so good at that dark crime fiction. Such beautiful places, but I guess there's a darkness there.
When you know, it's so far north too that they also don't
really
have,
north.
They don't have a lot of light.
No.
Right? Mm-hmm. And so that you know, in our moods, and you think about it. You know, as far as humans go, I mean, we had to follow the sun to stay warm and survive.
Yeah.
And when people live in places that are far north, it is not natural, right? It's not what we want to do. And it does, I mean, it has a profound effect on the psyche.
I go one day with gray weather and I'm down.
That's true.
We're spoiled out here.
Yeah, one of the reasons we moved out here
was the sunshine.
Yeah.
Yeah. We get a lot of sun out here.
Us and everybody else in the
February.
Country, apparently.
Oh, happy leap day, you guys.
Hey, it is a happy leap day, isn't it? Yeah. February 29th.
Did you know that, Andrew?
I did not know that today was a leap day.
Yeah.
And
do you care?
And some calendar I was looking at said today was March 1st.
Oh, really?
But I guess it was wrong. But I actually know somebody that was born on a leap day.
That's cool.
Yeah.
I used to, when I was a kid, I always wanted to have wished that my birthday was then. I feel like you get a lot of
attention.
Every
kid does, except for the kid who was born on February 29th.
That's probably true. Yeah. Did you know any Duffy rolls that you eat today don't count?
Eat as much as you want. Eat as many Duffy rolls as you could possibly want.
So I will go check the Facebook account of the person I know whose birthday it is today.
Oh, and see what it says.
And see if they have any comments.
There you go, yeah.
Oh, that's funny.
All right, that sounds like a really, really great book.
It's a great book set entirely on that small island,
Thunder Bay, and that's written by
Douglas Skelton.
Douglas Skelton,
good name.
I know, any relation to Red Skelton? I wonder.
Definitely not.
Okay. All right. Moving on. So my book this week is called 3/5 by John Vircher. Now this book, let me tell you, I think I have a new favorite so far this year. This book is
really
absolutely 1,000% brilliant.
Huh. So is this book about 3 bottles of alcohol?
How dare you, Andrew? How dare you, sir?
This book is absolutely brilliant. This is an emotionally charged, at times shocking, at times gut-wrenching. This is beautifully written, a character-driven novel that is not just a great read, but also, I feel, an important read. So this book is set in 1995 Pittsburgh, and it's going on at the same time as the O.J. Simpson trials were going on. You guys remember watching the O.J. Simpson trials?
I was I was in college, mm-hmm. so I didn't watch them, but I distinctly remember I was in art class and the art teacher bringing her radio in.
Yes.
So we could listen to the verdict. Uh-huh.
So this is back when Pittsburgh actually had a decent football team.
Do you remember where you were?
Andrew's just trying to get in a dig.
I know. Do you remember did you follow along with the O.J. Simpson trial, Andrew?
And so I lived overseas.
Oh.
And,
you probably didn't.
Well, and the coverage over there was, look at how racist these Americans are.
Really?
Oh, yeah.
Well, that's interesting you just say that, because that's a lot of what's going on. And you see a lot of white people sitting in bars and restaurants watching this and saying these horribly racist things.
Mm.
And then you see the perspective from the African-American characters and talking about it. And actually, the title of the book, 3/5, references the main character. Well, he's a guy who looks white but has a black father. So we don't know. So apparently he's probably 3/5 white, is my guess.
I see.
The author doesn't specifically say what the title references, but I'm guessing that's what it is.
That would make sense, yeah.
So this book reminded me a lot of a Stuart Onan book, in particular Last Night at the Red Lobster, because a lot of it is set in a... and it's got kind of that same melancholy tone, and it's just so well written that it kind of reminded me of
that. I still remember you reviewing that
book. Yeah, I really loved that book.
And Last Night at the Lobster, I think. That.
It's also another, it's kind of, it's not a Last Night at the Lobster.
Mm-hmm. Not the Red Lobster.
No, not the Red Lobster. unless he wanted to maybe try to get some corporate tie-ins. I wonder if he tried to sell that to the good people. How did he get away? The whole thing was set in a Red Lobster.
Yeah, but he didn't call it a Red Lobster. He just called it the Lobster.
No. He referenced the fact that it was all throughout the book. But not in the title.
Yeah.
But anyway, this is set in a restaurant, not a Red Lobster. Not a Red Lobster. A lot of it. And it reminded me of that. Also, just because... the tone of it and the fact that it's a slim tone, it runs in at around 200 pages, and just the writing is so concise. There are no words wasted here. It's just amazing how much life this author is able to breathe into these characters. These are real, just like Onan's characters. They're real, everyday, working-class folk. But in this case, they're dealing with some, not only just real-life issues, but also some issues that are a little bigger than life. This book is very much a character-driven novel. I laughed at parts of it. I literally, at one point, was sitting on the sofa sobbing so hard.
Really?
Hard, yes. While reading this, I had to take a moment just to get a hold of myself.
Wow.
That's how gut-wrenching of a book this is. So be prepared for that. There are parts in this book that made me angry. I was yelling at some of the characters. Just puts you through an absolute emotional ringer here. So you gotta, throw on your suit of armor and be prepared.
Be prepared.
Be prepared for this one.
But it's worth it, huh?
Oh my God, it's worth it. It's, okay. If you like taking emotional rides with your characters, like I do.
You do. You're gonna like that.
I really love that. Because, you know why, and I realize what it is, it's because they're so real. These read like real people. And so when you have an author who can
do
just
that
in a matter of a few paragraphs, create life
not everybody
on a page.
Can. Yeah, it's a good gift.
And make them these morally kind of, just the way that he describes them with so few strokes, and to give them such depth and emotionality to them, it's absolutely amazing. It's just a great gift that this guy has. And this is his first book.
Oh, it is?
It's his first book. Yeah.
Can I see the book?
Cannot wait to see what else this guy John Vercher has in store for us. And former guest of the show Paula Monnier is thanked in the acknowledgments and friend of the show. She's always liking and sharing our stuff on Facebook, and we thank Paula for that. But yeah, he thanks her in the acknowledgments of this book.
So is the book up for any awards that you know?
Ooh, good question. It actually is. It actually, I found out, was a nominee for best first novel for an Edgar Award.
Oh, wow. Mm-hmm.
Yep. So that was really exciting when I found that out.
Sounds really good.
So let me tell you a little bit about actually what it's about. The main character is a 22-year-old kid named Bobby who looks white on the surface but has a black father that he's never met. And in fact, Bobby's mother, not Bobbly. Sorry, I get a little excited about it.
That's okay. I had trouble with my words too.
Yeah, Bobby's mother told him his father was dead. So he always thought his father was dead growing up. Book opens up with a bang as Bobby meets up with his good friend Aaron, his childhood friend Aaron, who was his best friend growing up. In fact, they grew up reading comic books together and kind of bonding over that. Well, now he's here to meet Aaron, who just got out of prison. This also is a great book an anti-prison book, because what happens to you, and in particular the character of Aaron, this kind of goofy kid growing up who was into comic books, and just to see after a short stint in prison what he turned into. Well, Aaron is no longer the same fun-loving comic book reading kid. He's had a rough go of it in prison. He's been beaten up and violated in many, many different ways, and this has turned him into a white supremacist. And in the very opening scene of the book...
Didn't see that coming,
no.
Actually.
Well, Aaron and Bobby pop into a fast food type place for some pizza and fries, and at the restaurant is a young African-American kid. And quickly, a confrontation arises as this African-American kid sees Aaron's new jailhouse tattoos, including an iron eagle, lightning bolts, and spider webs. This confrontation escalates very, very quickly, and Aaron, much to Bobby's shock, ends up smashing a brick into the face of this kid.
Wow.
Before hopping into Bobby's truck and having the shell-shocked Bobby drive off. So this book takes place over the course of the next few days that follow. This incident hangs over the entirety of the book as Bobby now has to figure out what to do. Here he just saw his best friend growing up, this kid he read comic books with, who's now someone that he doesn't even recognize. And now he's just covered for him by driving him away from the scene of what could possibly be a murder. Mm. So he's got to deal with this, and just to see the conflict that's going on in his mind, trying to figure out what to do. He doesn't know, you know, he could be seen as an accessory now. He doesn't know if he's seen on camera. Meanwhile, Bobby's mother, and now Bobby still lives with his mother, they've been waiting tables and living month to month and shift to shift for years. One night, his mother pops into a bar for a late night cocktail. When lo and behold, who does she see but Bobby's long-lost father? And of course, she wants to reconnect with him, which, as you can imagine, brings all kinds of feelings to the surface, especially because Bobby's father, well, he didn't even realize he had a kid. Hmm. Obviously, Bobby's father is the African-American guy. He's actually a doctor now, and his first thought is, oh, this woman is just trying to use me to get money out of me because she sees I'm a doctor.
Ah.
This is just an amazing look at how we see ourselves and how others see us and how much of us is tied into all this. This is just brutally honest in the way it deals with race, as Bobby has to deal with the changes that have occurred in his best friend, as well as dealing with a new way of looking at himself as he finally meets his father. I can't tell you how much I love this book. You have to read this book. I cared for Bobby and his mother so much and pulled for him. Also, Bobby's father, his mother is dealing with her issues with alcohol. This is a two boxer. So I would describe this as a two boxer book. And Andrew, do you know what that means?
You're talking tissues here.
Yeah. So one box of tissues for yourself as you're reading it, and another box for yourself later on to dab at your eyes. Look, here's a Kleenex.
Oh,
right,
no.
Right here.
My other thought is boxer shorts, and I didn't want to go there.
I don't want to go there. That's funny.
So did Bobby know that his dad was African American?
Well, you'll just have to read the book and find out, won't you? It's very interesting the way it all plays out. I felt like I was a little cog inside Bobby's brain at times, just how much this author is able to really, really get in there. Anyway, the book is 3/5. The author is John Vercher, and that is my recommendation for this week. Andrew, what do you got for us this week?
So the book I'm reviewing this week is called Written in Red. And it is an Anne Bishop novel, and it is one of the Others series.
Ooh.
And that's written in red, like the color red?
Correct.
Okay, very
good. And this is book 1 of 5.
Hmm.
And this book is, it starts with the story of Meg Corbin, and she is a young girl who is, let's say, thinly dressed in cold winter weather.
Like Paige Turner.
Yeah, and she is running, and she is running for her life.
Hmm.
And you know, in this universe, and Anne Bishop really builds a great universe. You know, and in this universe, it is a mixture of there are the Others,
mm-hmm.
and the Others are basically, you know, we'll get into a little bit, but they're not human.
So, is this a fantasy?
It is a fantasy.
Cool.
Yep. But there's also the humans in the book. And the humans in the book, I mean, there's technology, there's cell phones, there's cars, and there's uh-huh. things like that, too.
Oh, so not a typical fantasy.
No, and so, you know, and I always think it's an interesting twist when you kind of have this fantasy element,
mm-hmm.
You know, and you have these other creatures that I'll get into a little bit.
See, I like it with modern
living
life.
With modern technology.
Life, yeah. I like that a lot.
Because that's cool.
It's the question is, how do those two blend?
Yeah.
And so, the you know, one of the...
So Charlene Harris does that with her books.
Yeah. Mm. I think this is finely done. Really, mm-hmm. I really like the balance here. And so Meg Corbin, you know, feels that she is going to be caught. She feels she may not survive the night.
Wow.
And then she sees an ad for a community liaison.
Mm.
And the ad says inquire at Howling Goodreads. And Howling Goodreads is a bookstore.
That's awesome. Oh, right. All right. You had me at that.
Nice.
Yep. Yeah. Okay.
I love a book.
This sounds good.
A book about a bookstore.
Yeah. And so you can have a howling good time reading this book. But so anyways, what a liaison is a liaison is kind of like a postal worker. And the liaison kind of basically interacts with humans, receiving packages and things like that from humans and giving them to the Others. Now, the place this takes place is Lakeside. The community is called Lakeside. And Lakeside is a community of different types of non-human creatures. And there are vampires, there are werewolves, there are crows, there are horses, there are elementals.
Hmm.
You know, and there are also other unknown types of creatures.
Wow.
Well, a lot of different creatures.
This sounds awesome.
So there's one.
So are the crows like, do they talk or?
Well, and these Others are all shapeshifters.
Oh, I see.
Of one type or another.
Love shapeshifters.
And
okay.
There's a little mystery in that because you kind of wonder, you know, did humans come to this planet after?
Oh.
Because as far as like the shapeshifters, it's like, well, you know, there's kind of like implied that maybe they shifted shape to kind of match the humans now.
Oh, I see.
But they didn't always because they're trying to fit. So Lakeside, the Others are actually trying to learn about humans and they're trying to learn how to live with humans. But, you know, in reading this book, one of the things that's interesting is, right, and this is, I guess, an original Andrew Dowd quote, is that...
Oh, here we go.
This book, you know, talks about humans in a way in which they're very inhumane.
Yeah.
Right? And so it personifies the creatures, but a lot of the humans in this book are really very inhumane. They are cruel. There's the politics, right? And I think we talk about humanity, but there are two sides to humanity. There's the humanity that helps the old lady across the street.
Mm-hmm.
But then there is the awful side of humanity that's narcissistic, that's you know, bigoted, that mean, and it's cruel to people.
Yeah,
you know, and that's the thing with the Others is the Others are just trying to live. They're animals. They are the way they are, right? I mean, they eat humans, right? as prey, but they're animals. I mean, it's what they do, and what they don't understand is they don't understand this duality of nature that humans have.
Mm-hmm.
And so it's just kind of a strange in the book that. The Others are more human than the humans are in this book. But but Lakeside is kind of an experiment where the others are trying to learn more about how to coexist with humans, right? I mean, they feel, well, there's something for us to learn, you know, from that. And as they shift, they've got their other natures, and then if they shift into human form, they develop more of the human tendencies, and it's always for these characters, it's always the struggle between that. So anyways, Meg goes and applies at Howling Goodreads for the job as liaison because she knows that if this community accepts her, she'll be safe from the people pursuing her. And so Meg is a Cassandra Sangue, and a Cassandra Sangue is actually a they can actually see visions, and they see visions, but only if they cut their skin. So they have to cut their skin very carefully in a pristine manner. And it's the reason why Meg is pursued is because she is one of the most sensitive seers. And so the people that owned her want her back because, again,
she's valuable.
Well, and going back to this, you know, inhuman nature, this dual nature, Cassandra Sangues are actually ruled as being property, right? They can actually be owned, right? You know, and you know we feel about slavery and things like that too. But in this society, they justify owning somebody, right? And that, and that's kind of it's one of the things of the book too. And of course, the animals, the others, they all respect being free. And there's one part in this book where a young animal is put in a harness to protect him. But the others basically see being put in a harness kind of like being in chains. But, you know, there's this symbolism between, you know, Meg, who is escaping from the chains of slavery. But then she puts somebody else in, you know, chains, but basically to protect them. And it's interesting, too, because the, you know, the reaction of the others who basically see this and they realize, well, there are chains and then there are chains. Right. And so I think that's really one of the beautiful things.
Does she try to pass them off as a pet or something?
Oh, no.
Okay.
You know, and I
don't give too much away.
Don't give too much.
I was trying to figure it out. Sorry. That's where my brain goes.
But you know, it's kind of like the juxtaposition. So this book is, it is a quick read. It's 500 and some pages, but
quick.
It's a lot of words. Yeah,
quick 500-page workbook.
And you know, it builds a beautiful world with the interaction. But again, when you look at this, a lot of the symbolism, there are a lot of deeper meanings and there are a lot of deeper messages to the book. But Meg is a very kind, caring character. She just wants to live, right? I mean, that is her goal because before she was in captivity. Her life was all through images. She didn't get to experience anything firsthand.
I see.
So she just wants to live. And so, you know, her escaping is the only avenue that she had. And in order to live, right, I mean, she goes to this haven and they learn to accept her for who she is. And she is an exceptional person. And she is exceptional in a lot of different ways that you'll find out in this book. And it's one of the great things is when you read a book like this, and you know it's the first in a 5-book series. You really look forward to seeing how does her character develop, because in the beginning of the book you learn that Meg pretty much has an expiration date on her, right? And you learn from different elements that no matter what, she has an expiration date on her, right? And that's the question is, you know, what is that? What does that look like?
Huh.
Have you read the other books in the series?
I have not. I've only read the first book.
Sounds good.
And, you know, but I do look forward to continuing the series, and reading the other four books. But it really is a great book. I love the contrast. I love the characters. You know, I love the fact that you've got wolves running a bookstore. You've got some unknown creature that.
Dude, these books sound so good.
Yeah, they sound
I'm
great.
Looking them up
really
right
excited.
Now.
Yeah.
And I, you know, and I don't know if there's been a movie or a TV show, but this would be a fantastic, you know, sci-fi series. Yeah,
cool.
Yeah, but the book is Written in Red by Anne Bishop.
This sounds so good.
And that's recommended by.
Down.
All right, good one, Andrew. Really good one. We'll check that one out for sure. Now it's time for the
audiobook of the week.
My audiobook of the week has got one of my favorite titles I've ever read. The name of the book is called Naked Came the Florida Man. And this is written by Tim Dorsey, read by Oliver Wyman. A great read on this one. And just a really fun book. Here's a fun book that you're going to have a good time with. And you're actually going to learn a little something about the state of Florida. So if you ever found yourself wanting to learn a little bit more about the state of Florida, this is the book for you. This is a raunchy, riotous road trip through the state of Florida. It features two characters who are staples of Tim Dorsey's books. One is Serge, who is a homicidal, out for justice, wisecracking Floridian, and the other is his friend Coleman, who likes to sit next to him and take long hits off of his bong. Now, the two of them take a cemetery road trip tour of Florida. Now, Serge, along the way, he gives many history lessons at stops along the way. Very interesting history, I should add, including a lot of interesting factoids about the way you get. So it's all set in the state of Florida. So, Andrew, I don't know, have you spent a lot of time in Florida?
I mean, I spent a few weeks of my entire life off and on in Florida, yeah.
But this, what I like about this is it's not the typical Florida. When you think of Florida, you know, maybe a lot of people think of Disney World and Orlando and the theme parks there. Here you get off the beaten path and you realize Florida's been around for a long time and there's a lot of history. Very interesting history, I should add, including a lot of interesting factoids about the writers Marjorie Kinman Rawlings and Zora Neale Hurston. Now, Zora Neale Hurston is actually a writer that I've taught a lot in school. She wrote Their Eyes Were Watching God, a great writer, and I learned even more about her while reading this book. Oh, and also Flipper. You remember Flipper, the dolphin from the old TV show?
Oh, yeah.
Yeah, so there's a lot. So they get to visit his gravesite here in this book. Or hers. I don't know. So Serge is the kind of guy who will hold court and wax poetic standing over a forgotten mass grave about the lost lives of African Americans in a hurricane one moment, and the next he's extracting some mercenary justice on reprobates of society by inflicting cruel and unusual punishment on them as he holds them hostage in motel rooms. And now here's where he gets very creative. He takes so what he did with this one guy, he shaved the guy's head. Then he took a cheese grater to the guy's head, and then he took a bag full of these bugs, these flesh-eating bugs. They're called screw worms, and these are real. I looked them up, and once these screw worms get into your skin, they just keep eating and keep eating and keep eating. Mm. And in fact, the deer population is susceptible to these particular screw worms, but they have a very interesting, doctors have a very interesting way of, if you've got one in your body, how to get it out. You put a piece of bacon on your skin because these screw worms are, and basically what is it? They're flies that drop the eggs into the surface and then they get in. But the screw worms are so greatly attracted to bacon that they'll come out of your flesh and go straight to the bacon. So it's called bacon therapy, and that's how you get screw worms out of you, just by putting some bacon on you. Well, our guy Serge does not do this to this guy. He just takes the bag full of screw worms and tapes it on top of this guy's head. And all the people that Serge does these creatively exquisite torture-like stuff to, they're people who deserve it, let's just say. Or at least in his, you know, like the TV show Dexter, where Dexter will kill people who are deserving of being killed. It's the same thing with Serge. He exacts his own form of revenge against people who deserve it. Now, the other storyline in this book is even more fascinating. It starts 8 years earlier and gradually works up to where it meets the main story. It starts off with kids. Now, have you ever heard of this? This is what they do, I guess, during sugarcane season when they harvest the sugarcane down in Florida. The people, the farmers, will have these controlled burns throughout the sugarcane to get rid of, dried excess sticks or whatever. But they'll put these controlled burns in, and kids from the neighborhood will go in, and as these burns are happening, rabbits are fleeing the fires, and kids from the neighborhood will run in and try to catch these rabbits as the rabbits are flying out, because they get like a dollar for a skin. In the book, they get like a dollar for a skin. And in this one community where all this sugarcane burning was going on and the kids were chasing the rabbits, there's a high proportion number of kids who've turned into NFL athletes from this area. And the supposition is that it's because they've grown up chasing rabbits all their lives in these sugarcane burning things. There's a documentary, I guess, you can watch about it. But really fascinating. I found it fascinating.
I mean, it's fascinating. I'm just, and I wonder, like, I could see this happening, 50 years ago, but it's kind of hard to imagine this happening now.
And it's still going on. I was reading about it last night.
Now I know I've heard in Florida, they've got some sort of creature from Africa, like some sort of a huge rodent from Africa that's like taken over down there.
Oh, really?
Have you heard about that?
No, I have not. Let's look that up. African rodent. Capybaras?
Oh, yeah.
The capybaras.
Maybe the capybaras, but yeah.
Dog-sized rodents, capybaras invade Florida. Yeah, giant rodents found in Florida. Oh, this is disgusting. Man.
And you thought my rat problems are bad.
My wild animal pet, largest rodent in the world. Oh, this puts your rats to shame. Yeah,
and I thought of a few... I've seen a few news stories on this, but
really?
There's definitely some strange stuff that happens in Florida.
Yeah, never a dull moment in Florida, and that's one of the things I love about this book is you just get so immersed in this Florida culture and all that. There's buried treasure, there's gold coins involved. There's a girl, Chris is one of the kids. She's a girl, but she's the one who starts chasing these rabbits too, and we watch her grow up and actually kind of follow her dream. She wants to be a football player, and so we follow her dream, and it's really fascinating to find. These are great, interesting characters, wildly unique and fascinating stories, merging real-life Florida history with the hijinks and antics of Serge and his partner in crime. I really love this book. Let's take a listen to a clip. This is Naked Came the Florida Man by Tim Dorsey, read by Oliver Wyman.
Zora Neale Hurston was a black woman traveling Florida in the 1930s. Not the best time for that combination in the Jim Crow South. Yet she carried it off with such class and dignity that you can only genuflect. She was a novelist, historian, anthropologist, and a standout in the Harlem Renaissance scene. Or that's how one avid Floridian put it.
Stetson Kennedy was often at the wheel of the car, said Serge, at the wheel of the gold Plymouth heading west on Avenue D. The state's connective tissue I spoke of earlier. Rawlings to Stetson to Zora. She roamed the back roads with him, preserving local history and chronicling her times. Kind of like us.
The Plymouth turned north as Serge chugged a travel mug of coffee.
Zora is often associated with Eatonville, one of the first self-governing African-American communities, which used to be north of Orlando and is now engulfed by it. They have a festival for her each year.
So there you go. This is fun, profane, and yet also moving and touching. I really enjoyed it and recommend that you give this one a listen. Naked Came the Florida Man. So check it out. That's our show for this week. Thank you guys so much for listening. My name is Dave Medicus. We will see you next week. I will give an adios for Laura, who had to take Sylvia out.
I've come to regard November as the older, harder man's October. I appreciate the early darkness and cooler temperatures. It puts my mind in a different place than October. It is a month for quieter, slightly more subdued celebration of summer's death as winter tightens its grip. Henry Rollins.
Panic, panic, hoard food, hoard food.